You are rolling?
Yes, I am rolling.
Are you rolling?
I am.
How do you like the new Red Bull?
We'll find out here in about 15 minutes.
the silver Red Bull? Mm-hmm. All right. Hi, I'm Chick McGee, and we are off the air. Oh. This is new Bob Schneider from Burden of Proof. For those of you lucky enough to live in Indianapolis, he'll be at the Rathskeller July 17th.
I had a dream I was dying.
Don't listen to this with a gun nearby. That's all I'm probably saying to you about that. This is, you know, most of the album's kind of laid back.
I've heard it's a little laid back, yeah.
The world was
Is he
going to
perform
fire
for us when he visits?
When he's on the podcast?
Yeah.
He'd better.
Okay.
All right. I'm your host, Chick McGee. That's my co-host, Jess. Hi, Jess.
Hi.
And that's Jason, our producer.
Happy to be here today.
And we have a very special guest today. It's the one, the only, Bob Jenkins.
Oh, I'm sorry.
From ESPN, from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, from
NBC.
NBC, from
Paramount Pictures.
Oh my gosh, you were in Ricky Bobby, weren't you?
I was in Talladega Nights. I've actually been in three movies, but Talladega Nights was the only one in which I was on camera. The other two were voice only. So yes, okay. I have an extensive history in film.
Now, you know how the podcast medium works? We can just say pretty much anything we want.
Oh, goody. No, I don't know what a podcast is. I grew up in the 50s, and so this technology has left me behind.
See,
or I've left it behind.
You and I think, are both people know who we are, but for very different reasons. You, primarily an adult, and me, I'm primarily known for being silly on the radio. And
there's nothing wrong with that.
And then hanging around. And,
as long as they pay you that way.
Well, we'll see about that.
That's how you, how you build and continue a career. It's just doing what they want you to do.
Yeah. So speaking of your career, when did it start for you? Where did it start for you? Was it here? Was it Indianapolis?
No.
Was it,
well, the auto racing part was.
Right,
but
right.
After I got out of IU, you know, originally.
You went to IU? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Did you play hoops?
Oh, no. Nothing that involved any kind of athletic ability or getting in shape, that kind of thing.
All right, okay.
When I was growing up in East Central Indiana...
Everything, first of all, everything you say sounds like a narration of a film.
That's great.
You know, what I'll have today for lunch is... Yes?
When I was growing up in Eastern Indiana, I wanted to be a rock and roll disc jockey.
Oh!
Because I used to listen to WYFE here in Indianapolis.
Right.
I used to listen to WING in Dayton, WSAI in Cincinnati, and WONE in Dayton.
I know all these radio stations.
And I wanted to be a rock and roll disc jockey because I loved music. In fact, I still do. So that's why I went to IU to get a broadcasting background.
Mm-hmm.
And when I graduated from, actually during my education at IU, I discovered that being a disc jockey was not where it was at as far as money was concerned. So I thought, well, I got to do something here.
Editor's note, I started as a disc jockey. Please continue.
See what
Bob.
I mean?
Yeah. See, go right ahead.
So I got into broadcast journalism, and that's where I got my first job in Fort Wayne, and then I went to Valparaiso.
Now, in Fort Wayne, was it WOWO?
No, it was WGL, which was, I think, one of the first radio stations in Fort Wayne. It could be one of the first ones in the country.
Yeah. Okay.
So I worked in the news department there for a little over a year, got the station in a lawsuit within the first 3 months.
Oh.
That was pretty cool.
Can you say what that's centered around or speak in vague terms?
Sure. I would check the city court documents every day as part of my news rounds. And I wrote down information that was in the current, you know, stack of stuff. And it was about a guy who had been accused of rape.
All right.
And so I went back and reported that on the air. And the docket from which I took the information was like 3 years old. And the guy heard it and he called up and said, I'm suing you.
Oh.
So they settled it out of court. I mean, it wasn't a big deal, but... It was one of my first experiences in broadcasting.
And you continued on.
Oh, yeah. Then I went to Valparaiso as news director for a very small station there. Mm-hmm. And about that time, of course, I've always been a race fan, but I never thought about the possibility of combining broadcasting and auto racing.
Right.
And so I saw a job available here in Indianapolis in April of 1972, and I moved here and was a member of the news department at WIRE. And again, through going to check the police beat and everything like that, I got to know a guy named Paul Page.
Oh, okay.
And the rest is history.
Yeah. I heard, I was listening one Sunday morning to WIBC, and they had, kind of a review or retrospective of all the gentlemen who'd handled the 500. It was Sid Collins and Lou Palmer and you and Paul Page and Mike King. And
right.
Incredibly interesting. The early days, were you in one of the turns? Was that one of your first?
My first year was in 1979, and I was on the backstretch. Now, the backstretch was a position that they put all rookies because basically nothing happened back then. If it happened in that area, it would be in turn two or turn three. Mm-hmm. But the backstretch was kind of a rookie position, so I think I spent 2 years there and then moved to turn four. And in 1990, after Lou Palmer, who had been appointed as the so-called voice of the 500, after he spent 2 years in that capacity, he was dismissed, and I was named as such.
Play-by-play.
Yeah.
I guess, that's what it's
tough
called.
Tough job.
Yeah, I don't... Do you have... You have, like, people reporting from all the different turns in your head that we can't hear on the radio, but you can, right?
All four turn positions. I'm not sure that it was, I don't think it was done while Lou was there, but instead of having all of the pit reporters in my ear also, in addition to the turn reporters, I established a pit producer, and they would all report to him in his headset, and then he would get my attention and point out on this board where he thought I should go for a report. So, yeah, it was a tough job because you're not only the play-by-play guy, but you're also the producer. And you got to watch the clock and get the commercial breaks in and blah, 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 blah.
And you got to have the rundown with Howdy Bell.
That's right, yes.
People are keeping track of where the cars are on every lap. Yeah.
And that was about the time that we were starting to kind of, you know, move in a different direction because it had always been that had happened in this location, and we wanted to bring it more up to date. It's a live broadcast. So one of the things that we just had to do because of that and the fact the cars were going a little bit faster, we had to condense things. And instead of doing 20-lap rundowns in the entire 33-car field, we just had to stop doing that and make it a little shorter.
Well, there's just not enough time.
That's right. Yeah.
Now, you were doing the play-by-play when the split occurred.
Yes.
95.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know,
from your perspective, I don't know if you want to personally. I mean, what happened, I guess?
Well, I don't know the politics involved.
Well, one of my good friends at the time was actually, it's Dave Wilson. And he more or less laid it out for me. He said, look, it's Tony's track. He can do whatever he wants to with it. That was basically what I was told.
And he thought that perhaps the sanctioning body was getting a little more leeway than they should have. So
Now, to be clear, it was USAC, and then it went to, or was it, it was IndyCar, and then it went to IRL, and then what?
No, it was CART.
CART, okay.
But then it just became the Indy 500, which was sanctioned by, at that time, USAC. And then that quickly went away, and it became the Indy Racing League.
Yeah.
But as far as I was concerned, 1995 was no different than any other race. Mm-hmm. It was because the participants perhaps weren't as well known as they had been. But for me, the Indianapolis 500, which began in 1911, was the same that year, 95, than it was in 1911 and in 2013. It is always... has been the big day of my year. It's the day that I look forward to from 1 year to the next. It is the largest sporting event in the world, and nothing will ever change that despite the fact that at that time there were very few participants that you really had heard of.
Mm-hmm. So was it? Did it get down to, was it that personal between the drivers and Tony George, or was it just the mechanics of the
car owners?
Cars,
yeah, the car owners, yeah, refused to race under that banner, which was not fair really to the drivers, because everybody still wanted to race in the Indianapolis 500, but the car owners just felt like they should hold their ground. And it was a great battle as to who was going to win. Would the Indianapolis 500, their biggest race of the year, be the victor, or would the car owners who were holding out and not participating going to win and force CART to sanction the race?
Man.
Yeah, remember that crazy. One?
That oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I remember
and,
that.
And Buddy won that year, right? Buddy, yep. Buddy mm-hmm. Lozier yeah. won that race.
Who, incidentally, was back this
yeah,
year.
Yeah, he sure was. He sure was.
Yeah.
Going back to you, you said you started in the backstretch and you got promoted to turn four.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a pretty big leap
from
backstretch to four. And so during the 80s, you were turn four for basically the entire 80s?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Including the race in which... John Cock and Mears raced for the victory.
And they probably don't remember this. I talked to Jake, a good friend of yours, and he kind of prepped me a few little things. And that race was, he said, it was his favorite call because Paul Page was the was the head, and you threw it to him in just an appropriate manner, because you didn't know who was going to win.
Right.
Paul Page, who's going to win the 500 kind of thing, right?
Yeah, you know, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network at that time, of course it isn't this way now, the only time this group of announcers would get together would be on race day. We would always call for a dress rehearsal in which we urged as many people as possible to go to their position on carb day and check it out. But there were a lot of people that couldn't because of their jobs.
There are parties, Bob.
Yeah.
There are parties.
Right.
Carb day.
A lot more important things to do than that. So that was the only time we really got together as a unit. And I also feel that the 82 finish was one of the best ad-libbed conclusions to an event in history. I really do. 92, yeah, I was in the chair that
now,
year.
Now, wait a minute. Now, I don't sell yourself short, because I remember 90, and you are just a few
hundredths of a second.
That shaking of your voice, and you were really moved by the... That's the one I remember the
most. Well, nothing... nobody will ever accuse me of not getting excited during race. And I still do, for that matter.
Sure.
But if you will listen real closely to the 82 broadcast and the last lap, and the 92 broadcast, the last lap, you will find a lot of similarities.
Yeah.
Because basically, Bob Lamy threw it to me the same way I threw it to Paul in 82.
Mm-hmm.
And I say a lot of things that Paul Page said when he called the winner in 82.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. There was an inflection in the voice, I guess, that was... And one of the things that I always listen to when I hear that, and Little Al wins by just a few tenths of a second, perhaps the closest finish in the history of the... It was Derek Daly, who was my analyst, my driver expert that year. You will listen very closely. He goes... when the checkered flag comes out. I love that.
Now, did Bob Lamy, did he know what he was doing? Because it's... ode to you.
Nope.
Yeah.
When you threw it to Paul, he seemed to do the same thing.
Yeah,
I took it.
I've never talked to him about that.
Okay.
Could be, though. Yeah. And, you know, the 92 finish was the clip of Lamy and me in those closing few seconds made into a Valvoline commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And it ran and ran and ran. And I kept saying, oh, my God. Gosh, I'm so tired of hearing that commercial, and then the next check would arrive, and it wouldn't be so bad.
Now, the 82 race, when John Cock wins over Mears, someone, I think it was Jay Baker, who's quite the race enthusiast, he made the point that there's no one else in the face of the earth that could have won that race other than John Cock, because he took so many chances. He was just a good old boy, just a little bit crazy, a little bit of a savant driving a car.
I think you could describe him that way. And by the same token, Rick Mears was pretty much the opposite. I mean, he wasn't going to take...
Very technical.
Not going to take any chances. But, Yeah, John Cock was out to win that year, and of course he would go on to win another one, and Rick would become a four-time winner. But
So, what is your, looking back over the years, what would be your favorite race? Is it 92?
Oh, yeah, without question.
I have to be 92.
92 was such a horrible year weather-wise because it was really, really cold and windy. And all of my turn reporters who were high somewhere on the top of grandstand or someplace were up in the wind. And it was just so uncomfortable. Of course, I was indoors and wasn't affected by the weather. But, you know, the turn reporters just kept calling me during a commercial break and saying, oh, my God, I just wish this thing would be over and we can get down from here and get warm. And then, you know, it turned into what it did.
What it was.
Still, it's, yeah, my... all-time favorite moment as far as my broadcasting career is concerned. And the second most, oddly enough, and I have very few fond memories of television working NASCAR, but my second most memorable race was the final race of the 1992 NASCAR season when we had three drivers that were eligible for the championship. And Davey Allison wrecked or something happened, so that took him out of the mix. But then it came down to Alan Kulwicki and Bill Elliott. And it ultimately came down to the driver who led the most laps that particular race getting a bonus point and winning the championship. So, and it was also Richard Petty's final race and Jeff Gordon's first. So
there's a lot going on there. So how did the... how did the, I think Ricky Bobby, Talladega Nights is probably one of Jess's favorite movies. Isn't that right?
Yeah, there was a time where I watched it daily.
The little baby Jesus? And
all that. Yes,
how
it's
did
a
that,
movie.
How did that happen? How did they approach you, or did you think they were messing with you?
At the time, I had been dismissed from ABC and, and was basically out of a full-time job, and so the people at... what was then called Speed News, which was the half-hour block of racing news on Saturday night and an hour block of news on Saturday on Sunday night on Speed Channel.
Right.
I was doing that.
Okay.
And I think that's probably what led to, because we shot it in Charlotte in the studios, and I still, by the way, get residuals from that. So if you would, please go buy a copy of it. For your husband, your boyfriend, your cousins, your
whatever's going on there.
Yeah, that's right.
So, did you meet Will Ferrell and the guys, or were you like in
No.
They just set you up in a studio, and you would.
Yeah, there was a guy with me, and I don't even know his name. He's a relatively well-known actor, but. You know, they sat us down and said, okay, here's what we want you to react to. This guy is a French NASCAR driver. He is gay. when the race is over and he wins, he creates the his boyfriend's name in the grass, you know. Like,
right.
So we both looked at each other and said, you got to be kidding me. And we did about five or six or seven takes, I guess. And on one of the takes, the final one, the guy who was with me and, you know, we had said to ourselves, well, they haven't liked anything we've done yet, so we'll do a little bit more. So this guy that was with me gets up out of his chair, starts yelling, throwing his hands, blah, 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 blah. And I thought, now that's the one they will use. But
right.
They didn't.
Oh.
They used my silly expression of, I can't believe this type thing.
Your shocked look on your face.
Now, what other movies are you credited in?
Days of Thunder with my good friend Tom Cruise.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Now, did you meet Tom?
No.
No Will Ferrell. No Tom Cruise.
No
okay.
Cruise. No, the question is, did they meet me?
Oh, that's right. Yeah. You're right. You're exactly right.
Nope, never met either one. I was only voiceover in Days of Thunder, but I went to Hollywood twice, once for kind of an orientation session, and then they asked me back. And it was pretty easy in that particular case. They just put me in front of this huge screen, and I watched what I saw on the screen and called it just like I would any other time.
Yeah. Okay.
So it was really easy.
So did that one seem more real to you than the... Oh, well, obviously it would.
Yeah, anything is more real than Talladega Nights. I think I've only seen that movie once because I know I can't take it again. And then the third movie I was in was really the best. It was a Canadian film.
Yeah.
And it was called Kart Racer, K-A-R-T Racer. And it was never released to theaters in the United States. However, at the is the one here called the Heartland Film Festival?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Heartland Film Festival.
It won,
right,
it won a prize, an award in that. And the night that they showed it, I was there, and the very young man who was the basically the star of the movie was there. Mm-hmm. And it was a good story. It was about a kid who whose mom, I don't know whether she'd passed away or anyway, he and his father were together, and he was getting on the wrong side of the track with drugs and blah, mm-hmm. blah, 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 blah. And so his dad, who was played by Randy Quaid, and the odd thing is that Randy Quaid has been in all three movies I was in. He must be trying to...
Really?
Yeah, he must be trying to...
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Now, did you meet Randy Quaid?
No. Oh. No, I didn't meet anyone. They just told me what to do, and I did it. But Kart Racer was a good movie, and... I don't get residuals from that, but I still do from Talladega Nights mm-hmm. And Days of Thunder. The checks amount to less than $50, maybe, eight times a year, something mm-hmm. like that. So I'm not a real high-paid actor. But, what the heck, it's easy money.
So do you commute back and forth from Charlotte, or do you...
Yeah, I went every week. I also got dismissed from that job, by the way, after only a year and a half, I think. So, at that time, I'm thinking, well, maybe I ought to get out of this business. And I was out of work, basically, until NBC came along and got the contract to do the IndyCar races, and got that job and served in the play-by-play position for 5 years, I guess. And then last October, September, I retired.
And that's what you're doing now.
Yes. I'm also working public address for some USAC races. The Silver Crown Series has 10 races, and they're all except for two within driving distance. So something to keep me busy doesn't burden me. Yeah. Yeah.
So what are your relaxing hobbies? Do you carve duck decoys?
Trying to be a rock and roll disc jockey.
Oh, really?
There's this small... low-power station in Brownsburg that you can't get unless you're sitting under one of its repeaters, but it's on the internet. And I've been doing that for, 3 or 4 years. I don't do a show every week, but there's a show on every week. They mm-hmm. They repeat. But it's a late 50s and early 60s rock and roll show, and I get a great deal of pleasure doing that because it takes up some time. I think of different themes that I use every week, then do a lot of research, writing, recording, and putting it together. So that's what I do. Other than that, I don't do anything. I'm retired.
Well, that's how I started here in Indianapolis. On remember WNDE Classic?
Sure,
1260 Classic Hits. I did afternoons on for a year, and then I got fired from that.
Amazing. Well, that broadcasting has been very good to me, but...
Oh, me too.
You never know. You never know from 1 year to the next unless you have a contract. And I did have a year remaining on my contract with ABC when they said they didn't have a position for me. So I worked for a full year while getting paid. But still, one of the reasons why I retired last fall is because I wanted to be the one that determined when my career was over and not anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So... I'm glad it did.
That's good.
Yeah, because you're still obviously very sharp, and I'm sure just as good, if not better, than those. Which brings it to a point of the 2006 500 was the one with Sam Harnish won.
Uh-huh.
And I really wish you were on the call for that on the TV, because if you listen, and I don't even know who those guys are, and I'm not trying to be mean, but it was all over the place. They had already called Marco the winner. There was no excitement until the last 5 seconds when oh wow Sam won, you know. yeah, it was very
Oh wow, Sam won.
It was basically they were surprised and they didn't give him a chance. There was no excitement build up to it. I mean, yeah. he obviously had a chance. He was within striking distance.
Right, right.
But yeah, as I watched a few clips here the last couple of days, I watched that one to see if you were on it and. It was evident very early that you weren't.
Yeah. Yeah, I was doing public address, I guess, at that time. Here's an interesting story about that race afterwards. I was assigned to ride around the track with Sam in the pace car to salute the fans, you know, like they do nowadays. And he and his wife were sitting on the boot of the convertible, and I was sitting in the console area facing backwards and interviewing Sam. Well, something happened going into turn number three. I lost my balance or something. I kicked the car out of gear. Rutherford goes, and I fall right into Sam Hornish's lap, shall we say.
Okay.
Yes.
Face first.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If anybody had a camera, there would certainly be some rumors going on there.
But it kind of, you said, it, what could it have been Johnny Rutherford's fault?
I don't think so. I take full responsibility for it.
You sure it didn't go into three a little hot?
Is it? I don't know.
So who, do you hang out with any of the former champions or any of the former drivers that we would know? Are you keeping contact with?
I told myself in my very early career that I would never make very good friends with race drivers, and I pretty much held to that. Really, I mean,
because
because of what happened to the driver that I probably became closer with than any other one my 33 years of broadcasting, and that's Dan Weldon.
Right,
exactly why I didn't want to get close to a race driver.
Yeah,
but yeah, I'm very good friends, I would say, with all of them. I don't think that anybody doesn't know me or know the type of person that I am, but I'm not real close with anybody.
You have any ordinary AJ stories?
You know, I knew where you were going to ask me that. And my answer is no. Not really. You know, I've admired the man for a long time because he was...
He's something else.
Yeah, he was racing sprint cars when I was first getting exposed to racing. And have admired him as a race driver for a long, long time. And
were you on the track during the famous when Kevin Kogan... Or he, AJ called him Coogan.
I was in turn four that year.
I thought,
I saw it happen, but yeah. Damn Coogan.
The damn, that's what he said.
Yeah.
Good old AJ.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, do you attend the race now, or do you just...
Oh, I still do public address.
Okay.
I'm helping Calabro. I think this was, I've been on the public address several years, but...
I thought I heard you out
there. Yeah, for the last three, I think, he and I have called the race. We do so from a booth on the outside of the track, kind of underneath the top, you know, the penthouse, and right at the start-finish line. So we do qualifying and also... the race. And it's fun because that type of job doesn't require a whole lot of research. I'm still involved, which I very, very much appreciate. And, you know, people ask me when I did announce my retirement last year, are you still going to be at the Speedway? And my answer was, I will be at the Speedway until they tell me that they don't want me anymore, because that's how important it is to me.
Wow. Do you remember your first race as just a fan going there?
Yeah. 1960 was the first race that I saw. My dad brought me here in 58 to qualifying, and I was in 58, 9 years old. Is that right? Yeah. So we went to qualifying, and then I told him that we got to go to the race. So in 1960, in 1960, we always, as a family, went to Lafayette, Indiana, because that's where my mom's family is buried. And of course, instead of Memorial Day back then, it was Decoration Day, and you went and put flowers on the graves of your loved ones. So we would always go to Lafayette and do the grave thing. But in 1960, my dad agreed that we would drive down from Lafayette to the 500. We parked downtown. We rode the train out to the Speedway. I remember walking to my seat. I remember a lot of the race because it was a good one with Rathman and Ward. And we sat in Grandstand C, which is right across from the pit area. And I remember standing up in my seat many, many laps looking toward turn four and telling my dad who was leading in that particular lap. So that, that was fun. The first race I can ever remember going to, the big race, was in 1957 at Dayton, Ohio. My brother, who's 6 years older than I, heard that the, quote, championship cars were coming to the Dayton Speedway. Now, the Dayton Speedway was a half-mile high-bank track, and so it wasn't a points-paying race, but there was a break in the championship schedule, and so a lot of drivers brought their cars to the Dayton Speedway. I remember a lot about that day. I remember parking on the outside. I remember going into the grandstand. I remember driver introductions and just a lot of things about that day. I remember it was a really big deal to me. My favorite driver at the time was Pat O'Connor. And O'Connor led that race, the feature race, until, I don't know, six, seven, eight laps to go when he was passed by Ed Elysian. And Elysian went on to win the race. On the way home, I was telling my mom and dad how disappointed I was that Pat O'Connor didn't win. And my mom suggested, well, his pit crew must have gone to sleep there and not told him how Elysian was catching him. And I really believed for the longest time that the pit crew
had
put their feet
sleep.
On some tires and took a 15-minute nap.
Had gone to sleep.
Yep, yep.
I remember going to, I don't know how familiar you are with racing in Ohio. I grew up in Central Ohio, and the Columbus Motor Speedway.
Uh-huh, sure.
I was, and that my favorite driver I had was Neil Siva or something like that, because I remember hearing Tom Sneva's name. And
yeah.
I thought, oh, that's really close to my favorite. But these were like stock cars? Is that what you saw at Dayton? Like, yeah.
Yeah, no, these were the championship cars. These were the cars they run on the dirt at the mile tracks.
Okay, okay.
But Eldora Speedway was probably the one that I would refer to as my home track, because we went to Eldora many, many times to see the USAC sprint cars.
That's Rosberg.
Rosberg. And then there was a track back then at New Bremen, Ohio.
Okay.
You familiar with that?
Yeah, I'm familiar with New Bremen, yeah.
Yeah, there was a half-mile dirt track there. Earl Baltus, who owns or used to own Eldora, bought New Bremen probably in the 70s and closed it, so it's no longer operating. But of course, Tony Stewart now owns Eldora, and it's thriving.
Sure. Good old Tony.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have any Tony Stewart stories? Ornery Tony Stewart stories?
No. I don't. Yeah, I have the world's. I have the world's worst memory, Chick. I really
are
do.
You kidding me?
No.
You just went through Elysian.
Well,
and
yeah, but those were really special moments. But I have done so many races that I don't remember one from the other,
have you,
except those two that I told you
have
about.
You ever done anything other than cars? The only basketball?
Other nope. The only other thing I did was in probably 1980 for ESPN, they sent me to a track and field meet in Syracuse, New York. And it was kind of a host thing. You know, I didn't have to do any homework or play-by-play. But that was the only one. Apparently, I didn't do a good job because they didn't invite me back. That was the only thing other than auto racing I've ever done.
You were talking about the dirt tracks. Did you ever do any of the World of Outlaws? Was that because that kind of got big in the 90s, right? And the only reason I grew up in Olytic, which is near Bedford.
Oh, yeah.
And the Kinzer family had their shops. I mean, I used to ride my bike by them all the time, and they got to be pretty big in that. I didn't know if you ever called any of that stuff.
Well, let me first tell you something, that as I have gotten older, I have gotten much more set in my ways. And I criticize perhaps things that I shouldn't criticize. But I do not like a lot of races. Ask me about another one, if you would, please. But I don't like wing sprint cars.
Okay.
Because that isn't what I grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
They, in my opinion, take driving skill away from the driver, because when you got this big wing on top and a lot of downforce, all you have to do is stand on the gas and turn left. And I don't think that's... what? So I don't go to wing sprint car races. I go to non-wing sprint car races. Still love those. In fact, it's probably still my favorite kind of racing, but never did the World of Outlaws.
Did you ever call any of the other ones?
Well, we used to do a program called Thunder on ESPN. It was, first of all, Thursday Night Thunder, and then it was Saturday Thunder, and then, you know, they kept moving it around. But, yeah, it was mostly USAC races, sprint cars, some at Eldora, some at Winchester, some at Salem, the very first race that I ever did for ESPN, which was the first race that ESPN did, mm-hmm. in late 79 was a sprint car race in Salem, Indiana, on the half-mile.
Now, 79 was when ESPN started, right?
Yeah, yeah. It was one of the first sports that that ESPN wanted to do. And so this was in, I guess, September or August, late August or early September of 79, that we did the first race. We did four or five races, and then in 1980, it pretty much became a regular thing on ESPN.
So they obviously approached you, ESPN people did, to say,
Well, before that, my very first time on television, period, was on NBC Sports World.
Oh, I remember that. Okay.
Because, again, Paul Page had taken me under his wing. They had hired him to do play-by-play for their races.
Mm-hmm.
And he suggested that I be the pit reporter. So the very first race that I ever did on television was the first kart race that was ever conducted at Phoenix International Raceway, mm-hmm. in April of 79. I don't know. I'm worse.
78, maybe?
78, maybe. Yeah, it would have been 78. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, did okay. The next race that they wanted me to do was called the Dogwood Classic at Martinsville, Virginia. And it involved late models and modifieds and some other, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't do a very good job.
Now, when you say that, what is that? What, you misidentified people?
No,
you...
I just didn't do my homework and wasn't familiar enough with the participants that they decided that they could find somebody else. So they never asked me back. But then, no, that was in April of 79. And then later in 79, when ESPN went on the air, they asked Paul who they thought would make a good play-by-play person, and he recommended me. And so that's how I got the job with ESPN.
Was that your first play-by-play?
Yes.
I mean, okay.
Yeah.
So
do you remember someone from ESPN telling you, well, we're going to have an all-sports station? I mean, sports station?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because when it came on the air, I thought, this is
going to... Oh, there's no way this is going to work.
Who's going to watch sports 24 hours a day?
Yes, I did.
And then they didn't have any sports but Australian football and racing.
Right.
And
right.
They didn't have the NFL. They didn't have anything.
Early days was very, very difficult. But yeah. I was told that if I stayed with this, that I would go places that I never thought I would, and I did, mm-hmm. because at one time I was doing some Formula One races, which allowed me to travel to Europe and do several races over there and see things that I never thought I would see. I dreamed about going to Monza, Italy, which hosts a Formula One race, because in 1957 and 58, the Indy cars ran on a huge oval there. It was in the movie Grand Prix, I guess. Anyway, I always had dreamed of going to Monza to see the high-banked, I think it was a three-mile racetrack, and mm-hmm. I got to do that. So, I stuck with it, and I did do a lot in my career that I never thought I would be able to do.
Wow.
Yeah, the ESPN thing. I mean, do you remember the office you first had an interview in or anything? Or
no, nope, there guessing... was no interview.
Okay.
Paul called me and Larry Neuber over to his house one night, and he gave us a microphone and said, here's how you do it. Really, that's the way it happened.
Oh, my gosh.
The first time I went to the ESPN studios in Bristol, Connecticut, I'm the worst with names. And
but the campus anything. Now is...
Oh, it's huge.
It's expansive and huge and goes on forever, but then
I
probably...
I can't remember the name of the president of ESPN at that time or the guy that was running things. And I thought, wow, what would I do if I ever met him? Well, I was in the hallway and I saw this guy walking toward me in shorts and flip-flops. And it turned out to be the guy who was the president of ESPN. Oh, this is going to be all right.
This is going to be all right.
So were you with ESPN basically continuously for a number of years, or was it kind of in and out?
No, I don't remember. we stopped doing NASCAR in 2000, and then I did IndyCar for 3 or 4 or 5 years. And at that time is when They told me that they didn't have a position for me. I still had a year on my contract. Then I was hired by Speed to do their news. And then when that ended, I was out of work until NBC came along.
So you were with ESPN for a solid, their first 25
about,
years.
About, 27, yeah. I okay. think is what it was. Yeah.
Not
yeah.
many guys can say that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Berman.
Yeah.
Bob.
Bob Lee.
Bob
mm-hmm.
Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the only two
That's
I can
it.
Think of.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was.
Did you have a locker? Was there a locker there?
No. The only time we would go to ESPN yeah. would be for their Christmas party, and I always hated that because it was cold in Connecticut. And, you know, you sit at a table and don't know anybody else. Plus, they kept going to the bathroom and coming out with stuff on their nose.
Could never
understand what they were doing back there. But
I assume those parties kept getting bigger and bigger.
Oh, yeah.
As they added channels.
Yeah.
I assume the
yep. Steve, I stopped going in the late going.
Well, let's do that. I'm going to think of my favorite race. You guys think of your favorite race, or I remember my favorite Indianapolis 500 was when Bobby Rahal won. That was my first year here. I think in 85. Is that right? 85, 86.
Yeah, Sullivan was 85. I think
Sullivan was spin and win, and then Bobby Rahal
because
he was from Dublin, Ohio, which is in Central Ohio.
That's right.
And it was a very. What do you remember about that race?
That Rahal passed on a restart in the late going and went on to win. See what I mean?
No. But that's very well. That's exciting.
I just don't remember from one year to the next. I can name you the winners of the 500 from after World War II until 1960 and 1971, and after that, I couldn't tell you who won what race.
Well, and I remember as a kid, Mark Donohue, too. And what sort of gat was it? Sunoco or what car he drove?
Yep.
Good old Mark Donohue.
Yeah, but that was before I came, but race drivers have been my heroes for all my life, and I still consider them heroes, regardless of whether they're male or female, or 19 years old, or 60 years old.
Now, Jess grew up here, but you said you only attended.
I've only been to one race, and it was when I was in college, so we don't really have to revisit.
Do you remember what happened?
No, I don't.
Who won?
You remember being at the Speedway?
Being at the Speedway, but actually, my favorite race memory is. We would spend our summers on Lake Lemon in southern Indiana.
Well, yeah.
And when I turned 10, that's when you were old enough to get in the pool. So it was 1991, and I was the first year I got to be in the pool. So that's my memory. I have no idea who my driver was.
You didn't win, though, huh?
No, I did not win. I would have remembered that.
That'd have been awesome at 10.
That was a lot of money. Well, my dad would have been like, I put your money in, so I get the money.
91 would have, I'm guessing, would have been Mears, maybe, or I'm not sure. Daggone it.
Here's my bit. You know Mr. Donaldson, I'm guessing.
Oh,
and if you have a guy like
that guy,
why do you need to remember anything?
Yeah, exactly. Right? Yep. Call him up or look in the books that you've got.
Yeah.
You'll figure it out. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great that he's still on the broadcast. I don't know. He's in his 80s.
Not yet.
Okay.
No, he's not much older than I am.
Really?
So he's probably early 70s. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. But he's still a walking encyclopedia of auto racing.
I'd like to compliment you. Have such a stylish haircut. I really, honestly.
That's
stylish?
Why she's on the podcast.
Yes,
she points
it is.
These
it's,
things out that we don't
really?
Notice.
Very modern, and you have a very nice haircut.
Well, thank you. That's the first time I've ever been complimented for that.
Well, there you go. Now, do you and your haircut, do you attend races regularly now?
No, not really. As I said, I'm doing some public address work for USAC doing their Silver Crown races, so that gets me to those.
So you never like kick back and go, okay, I've got a Saturday.
Yeah. Oh,
I've got
a Saturday
and I'm going to go to a race and just sit up in the stands.
I do. Kokomo really is the closest to my house, and they run sprint cars every Sunday night, and occasionally I'll go up to those,
They run Sunday night?
Uh-huh.
I did.
Oh, they got a great sprint car show up there.
Hmm.
And the track, they reworked several years ago, but it is just a fantastic little quarter-mile dirt track.
There's a racetrack by my house.
Yeah,
where? Kittley.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, when I was in high school...
here we go.
I started... I saw this rather good-looking young lady in my class... And so we started dating, and I found out that her father was a race driver, and he drove midget yeah. cars, and was one of those who drove pretty regularly at the Speedrome, which at some time was called the Kittley Avenue Track mm-hmm. or something like mm-hmm. that. And she became my wife, and so my father-in-law was a race driver, and that may have been one of the early reasons why I got involved in racing. I mean, right. I was a fan before that, right, but right. Having a father-in-law who had raced was kind of cool.
Everything
yeah,
in your life,
absolutely.
Everything in your life kind of started pointing toward.
Yeah, yeah, there was no denying that. It at that point. Yeah. If you were going to fight it, yeah. that kind of put it into it.
Yeah. Right. Probably right. did. Yeah.
That's great.
So now, when you attend these races in Kokomo and you hear the public address, do you just kind of walk up there?
Sometimes,
and go,
yeah.
Look.
Jerry. No,
Jerry, here's the thing.
I'm not into criticizing because I know how lousy I have been at times on the air, and so I'm not about to criticize anybody else for being lousy.
Have you ever been mistaken for any other broadcaster? You know, because a lot of times you're sort of somewhat faceless being on
so
the
you're
radio.
In the grocery store and you talk to somebody or you're talking to the and, they go, and they'll hear you and they'll go, and hey, are you Bob Lamey or something like that?
Used to be confused with Larry Neuber all the time.
Oh,
they didn't
yeah.
know if I was Larry or I was Bob, and so I've been called. And Dave DeSpain.
Been, he's gosh, very distinctive.
All those names. Yeah. Gosh, that's so great.
Yep.
Yep. It's I don't get recognized as much now as I used to when I was on the air every weekend doing NASCAR, but mm-hmm. but yeah, occasionally.
See, Chick's dream gig is to be the guy at Kroger. And
no, that might be my. You know, you're walking in Kroger, and every now they have what they call Kroger Radio. Have you ever noticed this in Kroger? They will. Thanks, Bob. They were.
You'll be shopping at Kroger, but I won't embarrass you.
So you'll be walking along, and someone will go, "Hey, welcome to Kroger's. You know, broccoli 3 for $4.
You know who does
right
my
now
radio?
At Kroger?
You're the guy?
No, not me. I want to be the guy.
What's the line? What's the best line, though?
Look at all those savings down there. That's what I want to do.
I would like to hear Bob Jekins do that.
You've got a career there.
I think so.
That is
JMV does Meyer. He's Meyer Radio.
No, he's not.
Honestly,
no way.
Honest.
John Michael does.
I just talked to him yesterday, actually.
Mm-hmm. He does Meyer Radio. Mm-hmm.
I remember John. You remember John Michael?
I do.
Yeah.
You know what I wanted to do when I was in high school? My first goal in life was to own a Dairy Queen.
Oh.
Because we had one in that little town that I grew up in, and I was sort of the assistant manager. So I was in there in the early morning making syrups and simple syrup and all that. And there was one day when I was making simple syrup, which, of course, is water and sugar.
Sure. Water and sugar, mm-hmm.
And we made it in these, I don't know, 10-gallon cans, I guess. But I was draining what was left out of one of the cans. And all of a sudden, the owner of the place says, "Oh, come and look at this. There's a big storm brewing." So I left spigot open and went out the back. And when I came back, there was simple syrup all over the place.
Oh.
And, of course, you couldn't walk there on it for a week.
It got sticky,
unless you lost your shoes.
So couldn't do that.
So do you still frequent Dairy Queen, or did that end it?
Well, no. They when he passed away, they sold it, and it's now they tore it down. But I told him when I went away to college that don't sell it unless you talk with me, and he did, and that ended my dream of owning a Dairy Queen.
Okay. You were surprised at how much an entire Dairy Queen would cost, probably.
But that was a little ice cream store, no sandwiches, anything.
Right.
So it would have been a really cool. And he closed, of course, during the winter from October to April or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I thought, boy, that'd be a great job.
What town are you from?
Liberty.
Liberty,
okay. Which is the county seat of Union County, mm-hmm. On the Ohio border, south of Richmond, mm-hmm. north of Brookville.
Yep.
West of Oxford, Ohio.
You were right there by Dayton, Ohio.
Uh-huh,
Eaton, Ohio.
In fact, I worked at a radio station in Eaton, Ohio during my spring or summer break between freshman or sophomore and junior year of college.
There was a rock station, because I worked in Springfield, Ohio for a little bit, and there was a station in Eaton, Ohio that you could hear in Dayton, and they really made a run at the Dayton market and were pretty popular for quite a while, and they played popular music at the time.
Uh-huh.
But their station identification, which you'd give the call letters and then the city, Well, there's, I forget, it was like GHZ or GTZ or something. And they would say, for lack, WGTZ, Eaton, Dayton, Springfield, alive.
Really?
That was their identification. I always thought that was so cool.
Yeah. The station I worked for was a mom and pop station, mm-hmm. WCTM. But yeah, it was fun.
Did you spin records at all when you were younger?
Yeah.
Okay, you did.
A little bit, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And
is it obviously it's always something you'd wanted to do because you've gotten back to it.
Yeah. In fact, last year for the first time, I went back to my high school as a rock and roll disc jockey, and we had a dance, a sock hop.
Oh, okay, you know,
and,
sure.
And people, some people didn't even know what the heck a sock hop was. What do you mean by that? But, you know, it was fun. I'm doing it again this year. I'm doing it for charity and mm-hmm. for the Union County School Corporation. But, yeah, I love doing that type of thing. I love 50s and 60s music. I have a collection of about 7,000 45s.
Oh, my gosh.
You're asking, cool. What is a 45?
I know what a 45 is.
Oh, yeah.
I had a Fisher-Price record player, and it played 45.
Sure.
It was Red, Red Wine.
On 45.
On a 45. Yeah.
By UB40, right?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
There you go. Yeah.
Well, I started collecting them several years ago, and it got out of hand.
Yeah.
And now I have 7,000, and... This past winter in February, I guess it was January, February, I decided that I would get out of the house for the first time. After my wife passed away, I thought I'd reward myself and do something. So mm-hmm. I took up the invitation of going to the Chili Bowl, which is a midget race in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Indoors. Oh, man. It is great.
Is that where they put the Coke syrup on the floor or something to help?
No, this is
sticky?
A dirt track.
They build
a quarter-mile dirt track indoors. The building is so large that they have a full quarter-mile dirt track at one end. In the middle of the building, they have the pit area, and in the opposite end of the building, they have a trade show. It is just incredible.
Oh, my gosh.
And they attract well over 100 cars, and there's racing from Wednesday all through Saturday night.
Oh, my gosh.
So I told myself that I was going to go, and mm-hmm. so I rode with a friend of mine, and it's a 10 or 11-hour drive.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, we went. When I got back that Sunday night, I stepped in the door, and I smelled something. And I traced the smell to my basement. It was my carpet rotting already because my sump pump had quit working.
Oh, no.
And my basement was, there wasn't standing water, but there were a lot of things that was water damaged,
right.
Including the cabinets on which I had my 45s displayed. Now, the water, of course, did not get into the records themselves, but the cabinets that they were on had to come out, and so I put all 7,000 of my 45s in boxes. That's where they are. I'm looking to get rid of them. If anybody wants to buy 7,000 45s, please write to Chick McGee.
They're 50s and 60s?
Most of them. Most of them.
Rock and roll, yeah.
Yeah. By buying collections in large amounts, I still have some 70s, 80s, 90s.
Mm-hmm.
But 50s and 60s are the ones that, you know, you look for and you want to buy. But the market has changed so drastically when I started because of eBay.
You
can find anything on eBay and for a tenth of what it was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So this is much fun.
How did you obtain most of your collection? Just rummage sales?
Yeah, when I would go to NASCAR races, I would look for record shops in a particular area. And, I can tell you where to go to buy a 45 in just about every city that we went to. Great warehouse in Richmond, Virginia. There's a store in St. Louis, all over the place. And I spent a lot of money on 45s and will never get even a small percentage of it back. But, yeah, it was fun.
But you had a good time.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah. Seriously, send that to Chick McGee at chickmcgee.com.
Sure, yeah. I'll share the profit with you.
No. Well, unless it gets really great profits, then, of course, we'll talk.
I'm sure it won't.
This isn't Ricky Bobby money.
No, that's not right. Ricky Bobby money. No, I'm not going to earn any of that. Well, Bob, thank you so much for stopping by.
Oh, my pleasure. I had no idea what the heck you wanted me to come out here for, but I'm glad you did because this has been fun.
Yeah, this
Where can we find your little radio show that you're doing?
It's radiobrownsburg.com.
Okay.
Oh,
okay.
No.
What?
Yeah. XRBradio.com.
XRBradio.com.
Yeah.
Okay.
Either that or RadioBrownsburg.com.
So how do you set it up? Do you, I mean, do you have a digital audio?
Yeah, I record it in my office at home.
Okay. Oh, okay.
And put it together.
That's cool.
Great. Yeah, it is. It's fun. It's a lot of fun.
So you're getting rid of all these records. Does that mean you finally got an iPod?
There you go. I know you do. You've got an iPod, right?
a what?
This thing that I'm looking at right now.
Oh, I got a phone that sort of looks like that. Anyway, through various means, I have on a external hard drive, I have about 18,000 songs.
Oh, okay.
I don't. Gotcha.
So now, do you put those on the external hard drive yourself? Oh, okay. We see you're more savvy than you're letting on. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Truly a legend in broadcasting.
Oh, come on. Yeah. Thank you for many years,
Bob Jenkins. Your voice. And
thank you.
Thank you, Jess.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Jason. I'll hit this button now.
Okay. It's not
too late. Once again, Bob Schneider. He'll be at the Rathskeller in Indianapolis, Indiana, July 17th. And it's coming now. There might be a drunk guy on stage that looks a little bit like me toward the end of the evening. You'll never know about that. Thank you, Jess. Thanks, Jason.
Good night, everybody.